The European Union proposes a ban on all imports of Russian oil. That would hurt Moscow and the EU, but many are ready to bite the bullet.
Because I think we have to stop Putin. So I think everyone have to pay a little bit more for stopping the war.
Higher oil prices in Europe will also have impacts worldwide, but that's not the only thing driving global inflation.
People want to buy a lot of stuff, and limited supply, there's not that much stuff to buy. Prices go up.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a very long bicycle ride from London to Tehran that led to a memoir about that adventure.
People love a cyclist. I think they slightly pity you. I think they kind of think you're a little bit mad, perhaps, but they're really grateful to you for going to all that effort to go and visit them, so they invite you into their home.
And voters in Northern Ireland could potentially make history. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Wednesday. The ace in the hole, the European Union played its strongest economic card against Russia today, a proposed ban on all imports of Russian oil. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said, quote, Putin must pay a high price for his brutal aggression. The EU is also proposing sanctions on Russian military officers, Russia's largest bank, and three Russian broadcasters from European airwaves. The World's Carolyn Beeler kicks off our coverage today in Berlin.
Ursula von der Leyen got a round of applause when she said this at an EU meeting this morning.
Today, we will propose to ban all Russian oil from Europe. This will be...
If the new sanctions are approved by all 27 member states, Europe would stop buying crude oil from Russia within 6 months.
And let's be clear, it will not be easy. Because some member states are strongly dependent on Russian oil, but we simply have to do it.
About 60% of Russia's oil exports go to Europe. The proposed ban comes after Germany, Europe's largest economy, dropped its opposition.
Mein Haus in der Vergangenheit hat dafür gearbeitet hat.
Robert Habeck is Germany's Minister of Economy and Climate Protection.
An uns soll es jedenfalls nicht mehr scheitern.
On public TV here yesterday, Habeck said that Germany will not stand in the way of a Russian oil ban. Before the war in Ukraine started, Germany got about a third of its oil from Russia. Now that's down to about 12%. Robert Habeck acknowledged that oil prices, though, will still go up if there's an embargo.
Und das ist der Preis, der getragen werden kann und getragen werden muss, allerdings...
That's the price that must be paid, he said. But it no longer means the entire German economy will collapse. It's easy to see how Germans still rely on Russian energy so much, especially here in Berlin. Commuters right now are pulling into a gas station I'm at in an after-work rush. Most gas stations in this city, which is the biggest in Germany, get their fuel from a refinery near the Polish border, about 60 miles northeast of where I am right now. That facility is owned by Rosneft, Russia's state-owned oil company. So the question is, where will Berliners get their gasoline if that source goes away?
Wir haben hier ein Problem, was wir versuchen zu lösen.
Michael Kellner, who represents Berlin in the German parliament, said on German TV yesterday that, quote, we have a problem here that we're trying to solve, namely that we have put critical infrastructure in Russian hands. The German government is now pushing a proposed law that would allow it to take temporary control of key energy infrastructure. If that happens, oil from other countries could be shipped to that refinery that supplies Berlin, Kellner says. However Germany resolves this problem, prices at the gas pump here are likely to rise higher. The price of crude oil jumped 3% today with the news of the EU's planned embargo. Back in March, gasoline shot up to $9 a gallon here in Germany. And that has been the most visible impact of the war so far for many Germans, including Fabian Neumann.
I have to pay much more for my car for the oil. So that's very much.
Neumann is an optician in Western Germany. She says rising gas prices from an oil embargo would be worth it to her.
Because I think we have to stop Putin. So I think everyone have to pay a little bit more for stopping the war.
Hospital worker Alex Hoberg is not so sure.
It depends. Because of the prices, they will rise and everything will be expensive. But on the other hand, it will be maybe a good thing to set a kind of limit.
A limit on Putin and his power. Officials in Ukraine have been calling for a full embargo on Russian energy for weeks. Moscow rakes in $850 million a day in natural gas and oil sales to Europe. But some Ukrainians who've lived through the horrors of the war are skeptical that an embargo would force Vladimir Putin to change course. Liza Brazimova fled from Kharkiv to Germany in early March with her family.
There are so many sanctions already made. The whole world is shouting. Ukraine is crying and shouting, and unfortunately, it goes on. Personally, he doesn't feel that pressure, and like no matter what, you stop.
European officials are meeting starting today in Brussels to discuss the sanctions package with an aim of approving it by the end of the week. But there's still resistance. Hungary and Slovakia, both heavily dependent on Russian oil, have said they do not support an embargo. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler in Berlin.
Americans are also seeing the rising cost of energy every time we fill up our gas tanks and pay our electric bills. We're also seeing high food prices and continued supply shortages, all part of the inflationary spiral being felt around the globe. We wanted to try and make sense of it, so we got in touch with Jacob Goldstein. He's host of What's Your Problem, a podcast about business and technology. Let's start with those gas prices, Jacob. Are consumers around the globe experiencing the same price hikes when they go to fill up their tanks?
They are. You know, one of the really striking things about oil is it is a global market, right? So when the price of oil goes up in one place, pretty much it goes up all around the world.
And the last time I was in Europe, that was a few years ago, gasoline prices just seemed to be at least double what we pay here. So how bad is it in Europe right now?
It's really bad. I mean, to be clear, inflation is about the rise in prices. But gas prices are going up a lot in Europe, driven in large part by the war in Ukraine. They're seeing overall inflation in Europe is not as high as here, but their rise in energy prices is just astronomical right now.
Americans are also seeing higher food prices. What are food prices like in other parts of the world right now?
Also rising really rapidly, also in part because of the war in Ukraine. Ukraine is a major exporter of wheat. And in the developing world, that is an even bigger deal, frankly, than it is in the U.S., because in poorer countries, people spend a much larger percentage of their income on food. So a rise in food prices is bad here, but it is much, much worse in poorer countries. In Egypt, for example, they rely a lot on imported wheat, and they're having significant problems now because food is getting more expensive. Wheat is getting more expensive.
Our correspondent in Southeast Asia recently told us about the favorite brand of instant noodles in Indonesia, and they're going through the roof. What are lower income countries doing to fight rising food prices?
You know, it's limited, frankly, what they can do. One thing you're seeing in North Africa and Egypt is they're getting more aid. The oil-rich Gulf countries are sending billions of dollars to Egypt now in order to help them pay more for food. But there's not a lot they can do.
So I have a basic economics 101 question here. What are the main causes of inflation? And specifically, what are the causes of this current period of rising prices?
The main causes always and also now are two big things. One is supply and the other is demand. And so we've been talking a little bit about supply, but let's talk for a sec about the demand side, because that's also really important right now. So despite this high inflation that we're having, the economy is actually quite strong. You know, unemployment is near historic lows, wages are rising, and government provided a lot of stimulus to help people get through the pandemic. And as a result of all these things, consumers have a lot of money and we're spending a lot of money. We're buying a lot of stuff. We want to buy a lot of stuff. So demand is strong. At the same time, supply is somewhat constrained. It is growing. We're buying more stuff than ever, but it's not growing as fast as we want it to grow because of the war in Ukraine. As we mentioned, that's constraining supplies of energy from Russia and wheat from Ukraine. Also because of the COVID lockdowns in China, importantly, you know, China is taking this very, very aggressive stance still to COVID. And partly as a result of that, the output of China's manufacturing is actually falling now. Over the last couple of months, it's been falling. So when you have strong demand, people want to buy a lot of stuff, and limited supply, there's not that much stuff to buy, prices go up. You get inflation.
Mm. Is the way then out of this global inflationary spiral clear, or are we historically in uncharted territory? I mean, you described the supply and demand tension. That seems unique. What is the way out?
Yeah, so the demand side, that side is pretty familiar, right? You have kind of an overheating economy, people wanting to buy more and more stuff. And the classic response there is the central bank, the institution the government charges with managing inflation in the U.S., that's the Federal Reserve, raises interest rates. And just today, we saw the Federal Reserve, U.S. Central Bank, raise interest rates by 0.5 percentage point, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot. We're seeing other central banks doing it too. It happened today in India. It's been happening in England. And what raising rates does is it makes it more expensive to borrow money, to go out and buy a new house or buy a new car. It also makes businesses less likely to keep borrowing and hiring and expanding. So raising interest rates cools the economy and lowers demand. The supply half is a little weirder.
Specifically right now, you mean?
Yeah, well, because A, what are the two big supply problems? Well, a pandemic and a war. So we can get demand down, but the supply piece is a little harder to see what's going to happen.
Jacob, you follow inflationary cycles. What are your concerns about this one?
Well, sort of the classic thing that happens when inflation goes up and then the central bank raises interest rates to fight inflation, right? They're raising interest rates in order to lower demand. But if they do it too much or too fast, demand goes down so much that you get a recession. Companies start laying people off, right? That is bad. And that is a totally plausible outcome of what is happening right now. So in short, I think the big risk is that the Fed, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, as it is trying to fight inflation, will unintentionally cause a recession.
Is a recession something that could happen in other parts of the world?
Yes, on two levels, right? On one level, because lots of central banks in lots of countries are raising interest rates, and that often tends to cause a recession, there could be just the direct version of it. The indirect version is the U.S. is such a central piece of the global economy that if we have a recession here because we're raising interest rates, that could have knock-on effects on other economies and hurt their economies, possibly contribute to recessions in other countries that way.
Jacob Goldstein is host of What's Your Problem, a podcast about business and technology. Thanks very much, Jacob, for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
We hear a lot about gun running on the U.S.-Mexico border, guns going north, guns heading south. What we don't hear much about is gun running on the U.S.-Canadian border. This past week, though, there was a noteworthy incident. Canadian police got a call that there was a drone stuck in a tree in Port Lambton, Ontario. That is a small village on the Canadian side of the border, northeast of Detroit. When the police showed up, they found more than just a drone. They found a plastic bag attached to the drone with carabiners and electrical tape. Inside the bag, 11 handguns. The tree was on a property belonging to Christine Ackwood. She told CTV News what happened.
Our neighbor had spotted someone in our yard in the middle of the night. And he had a remote control. He wasn't sure what was going on.
So Christine's neighbor went out to investigate.
When he spooked the guy lost control of the drone and it went into one of our big trees in the backyard.
The drone pilot then jumped into a waiting car and sped away. Canadian law enforcement believes the drone and guns had traveled from the United States across the St. Clair River. A really wild tale, and yet not that wild, says national security analyst Julia Kayyem with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
The use of drones to serve as a sort of smuggler capacity has been documented in the past and has been of growing concern to law enforcement. That is why you're similarly seeing a lot of law enforcement look into counter drone capacity, the ability to shoot down drones or protect places like a border.
So using drones for smuggling, not all that new.
What's new in this case is that the hero against the smugglers is a tree.
The tree ought to receive the Cross of Valor for extraordinary bravery. That would be nice. Whoever sent the drone and whoever was supposed to receive the delivery remain at large. Coming up, China has taken draconian steps to eliminate the spread of COVID. Today it's shutting down some subways in Beijing. Case numbers there are very low.
But when that strategy is imposed after the virus already is everywhere, then it will be too late.
That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Beijing today, a massive shutdown of the subway system. China's capital city closed more than 10% of its subway stations to try and combat rising cases of COVID. It is the latest example of China's zero COVID policy in action. Here on the show, we've been reporting a lot on the social and emotional toll of shutdowns. Today, we look at the public health impacts. While other countries like the U.S. have taken a live-with-COVID approach that puts the emphasis on vaccines, China's zero-COVID strategy prioritizes stringent lockdowns. To tackle all of this, we turn to Yanzhong Huang. He's a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. I asked him if Shanghai's now month-long lockdown is working from a public health perspective.
Well, the strategy can work to cut the transmission, and if it's implemented in a speedy manner, it could potentially reset the cases to zero in a short period of time. But when that strategy is imposed after the virus already is everywhere, then it will be too late. This is what we are seeing in Shanghai.
So the way we're seeing these lockdowns imposed and the impact on the economy, you're saying it's not working?
Well, you know, that way you talk about the social economic cost associated with that strategy. You know, we're talking about the disruption of the supply chain, the threat to achieve by the national economic growth targets, the other, you know, problems like people denied access, you know, to emergency care. Well, this is, you know, certainly, right, this is the big problem, you know, that we're seeing, right, this rapid increase of the social economic cost that make this strategy not justifiable.
Clearly, it's not normal what's happening in places like Shanghai and parts of Beijing. Why is then China doubling down on a zero COVID strategy? And are these strict lockdowns a critical tool of zero COVID?
Well, certainly they believe so, right? That in order to avoid the worst case scenario, you know, that is the overwhelming of the country's healthcare system, you know, the mass die off, the potential also threat to social, you know, political stability. Zero COVID is the only correct approach. But the problem, again, is that they cannot eradicate the virus. And in a way, it also sustains the huge immunity gap between China and the rest of the world. We talk about this high percentage of the population that either not exposed to the virus or have very low immunity level. You know, so, you know, when you have such a large population shielded from the virus, you know, by the zero COVID strategy, this immunity gap continued to exist, and that further justifies the use of zero COVID strategy. You know, so it's sort of like a vicious cycle here.
I guess we also have to look at the numbers, because in the U.S., we're approaching 1 million reported deaths from COVID, in China, just 14,000. So at the end of the day, has China simply done what's necessary, or do you see maybe there could be a third way of dealing with this?
Well, you know, I do believe, you know, there is a more cost-effective alternative to deal with that. It cannot prevent what's inevitable, that's the spike of cases, but it can minimize the damage, you know, if choose to take, you know, a mitigation-based approach, you know, that focuses on protecting, vaccinating the elderly, you know, making effective vaccines and antiviral pills available to this segment of population. In the meantime, introducing effective triage procedures so that the hospitals only treat the severe cases. And in this way, I think you know, you can avoid indeed the worst case scenario, even though you are still going to see the rapid increase of the cases.
Yanzhong Huang is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been speaking with us from New York. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Around 7 years ago, a British journalist came up with an idea. Rebecca Lowe wanted to ride her bike from her home in London all the way to Tehran, the Iranian capital, about 3,500 miles. Her friends and family thought she'd gone mad, but Rebecca told herself, "Never trust people who say things can't be done." The world's Shirin Jafari has her story.
Lowe admits that she didn't have much cycling experience.
I didn't really have all that much. I didn't have any tour cycle experience.
There was the one time she cycled from London to Paris for a charity event. Lowe was placed on Team Rhino, the slowest of all. And then there was the fact that she didn't have a bike. Luckily, a company agreed to sponsor her and sent her one.
And it arrived the day before I was due to leave because it was fresh off the production line. It was a new bike. And so I didn't have any time to practice on the bike.
It was a rocky start. But Lou was determined. She had been fascinated with travel in the Middle East. She visited with her family as a teenager. Now that she was older, she wanted to get to know the region better. Not as a tourist, but as a student of history and culture.
I wanted to really get buried in among it, among the people and the places.
And what better way to do that, she says, than on a bike? It's fast enough to be invigorating, slow enough to be immersive. Her trip started in France, and pretty quickly, doubts started to set in. Can I really do this? She asked herself.
The temperatures got very hot in France, so I was really suffering at the beginning.
Slowly, as Low made her way across Europe and into the Middle East, things started to look up. Local people were going out of their way to help her out.
People love a cyclist. You know, I think they slightly pity you. I think they kind of think you're a little bit mad, perhaps, but they're really curious about you. They're grateful to you for going to all that effort to go and visit them. So they invite you into their home.
Of course, there were problems too. Punctured tires, dangerous roads, annoying men. This was also in 2015, a time when millions of people were on the move, fleeing war and persecution. Low says as she crossed one border into another, something started to sink in.
Most people in the world do not share the kind of privilege that I have. The vast majority of people don't. And me just being on a bicycle was a kind of symbol of that freedom, in a sense. I was whisking in and out of these communities. Borders meant nothing to me.
Lou writes about her year-long journey across Europe and the Middle East in a new book called The Slow Road to Tehran. The trip took her through Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Sudan, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. Sure, she says, the smell, the color, the architecture of the places she saw all dazzled her. But it's the people she met along the way that have stuck with her the most.
There was a wonderful woman in Sudan, actually, called Awadea Mahmoud, and she was a tea lady.
She sold tea by the side of the road, but led a campaign to organize women tea sellers in Sudan. In Iran, Low met with a defiant women's rights activist, Nasrin Sotoudeh, who'd been in and out of prison for her activism. Low ends her journey in Iran, one of the most demonized countries in the West, as she describes it. What she saw there was different.
A lot of what we read in the newspapers inevitably is about the leaders, about the politics of these countries. And then you tend to believe that those leaders are somehow a shorthand for the culture and the character of the countries. But they're not actually, especially...
People and places, Law says, are complex. Their stories never black and white. And that's often easy to forget. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Coming up, the new British plan to send would-be migrants to Africa. You're listening to The World. For decades, Haitians tuned into Radio Haiti with Jean-Dominique.
There is something going on in a small piece of land called Haiti. But this country has something to tell you.
The influential broadcaster was killed more than 20 years ago, but the voice of Radio Haiti lives on. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Ever since the creation of Northern Ireland a century ago, pro-British parties have been the biggest political force there. Tomorrow, that could all change. People in Northern Ireland will vote in parliamentary elections, and polls indicate that Sinn Féin, the former political wing of the IRA, could, for the first time, become the largest party there. That is stoking worries that a referendum could be in the works to reunite with the Republic of Ireland to its south. But as Andrew Connolly reports from Belfast, voters across the political spectrum seem keen to not reopen any historical divisions.
The South Belfast Protestant Boys Flute Band lead a parade of several dozen men in suits, sashes and bowler hats down the Donegal Road. Violent standoffs have occurred previously when these overt displays of Protestantism and loyalty towards Britain marched near Catholic nationalist communities. On the other side of town, a new generation of Northern Irish Unionist politicians are trying to do politics at a lower volume.
Hello, how are you? I'm sorry to disturb you. My name's Lauren Kerr. I'm running for election in the area next week.
Lauren Kerr is the 30-year-old candidate for the pro-British Ulster Unionist Party. On a drizzly Saturday morning, she's canvassing in a working-class neighbourhood of East Belfast. Though the area is predominantly unionist, Kerr finds that the fear of a Sinn Féin victory isn't the main thing on people's minds.
So the constitutional question is important to people, but also, you know, people are waking up every morning and their fuel prices are rising, food's getting more expensive, they're worried about school places, hospital waiting lists, things like that.
Even Sinn Féin's manifesto is relatively quiet on the issue of reuniting with Ireland, instead concentrating on the bread and butter issues, a reflection perhaps on recent polling suggesting that increasing numbers of Northern Irish voters are no longer defining themselves as unionist or nationalist.
You know, first and foremost, I identify as Northern Irish. You know, I think this place is somewhere to be proud of in terms of the journey that we've come on.
Surveying people on an afternoon in Belfast's busy central shopping district, feelings on Sinn Féin are mixed. For some, it's not a big deal.
I think it's inevitable. Yeah. It's just the way things are going, yeah.
People's mindset has changed over the years. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to vote tribally as much.
Yes.
You know, there's more middle ground, isn't there?
There is, absolutely.
Yeah.
More rational thinking.
Yeah.
So people are voting this time on economy, sort of cost of
NHS,
living.
Yes, all those things.
For others, it's a very big deal.
It's a democratic election. It's well tested, and whatever it will be. But it's important that reconstituted terrorists do not govern me.
And then there are the single-issue voters.
Anyone who is pro-life.
Pro-life, yeah.
I will be voting. Anyone who's pro-life.
Father Gary Donegan gives Sunday Mass at the Holy Cross Church in the Ardoyne area of northern Belfast. Among his blessings is one for peace in the workplace, something that for him was shattered here a month ago. Masked gunmen in town had forced a man to drive a van to an event on the church grounds, carrying what he believed to be a bomb in the back. The visiting Irish foreign minister had to be evacuated mid-speech.
As I was running back and forward, it was trying to stop because cars were driving into the grounds. We had to get them to turn around immediately because they were right into where the device was, or the proxy device was.
The bomb was a fake, though the fear was real. It brought uncomfortable echoes of the height of the Troubles when Belfast was a war zone. And though Father Gary is from the nationalist community, he doesn't want a united Ireland at any cost.
You know, if there was ever to be a new Ireland or a new island, whatever like that there, it could never be that you could sit in any way at ease if the oppressed became the oppressor. It would either be equal or nothing.
They may come out on top in tomorrow's election, but Sinn Féin will still need to govern alongside their unionist rivals in government, though for most in Northern Ireland, political deadlock is still preferable than returning to the darkest episodes of the past. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in Belfast.
The UK has a new plan to deal with migrants and asylum seekers crossing the English Channel by boat. Send them to Rwanda. Rwanda will receive about $150 million from the UK to take in the migrants. It is a controversial plan, but other nations like Australia have done this kind of thing before, sending refugees to third countries. Here to talk about the plan for Rwanda is Théogène Rudasingwa. He's a former Rwandan ambassador to the US and joins us from just outside Washington. I know you've been a vocal critic of this plan to send migrants coming to the UK to Rwanda. Can you explain why you're critical of this?
First of all, of course, this is not the first time that such arrangements are being made. A couple of years ago, Israel made similar arrangements with Rwanda to send Eritreans and other African migrants to Rwanda. And subsequently, the European Union made a similar deal to send Libyans to Rwanda. And of course, once the UK plan was out, Denmark is making similar arrangements. But the extent of the UK plan, I found it quite shocking. On three grounds. One, that it's against international law because UNHCR has very clear stipulations as to how you should deal with refugees. Number two, you are sending refugees to a country that has a very, very grim human rights record. And number three, when refugees run to you, the first thing that you should be thinking about is not porting them to another country.
So what is in this scheme for Rwanda, aside from money? I mean, as you said, they've been doing this with a number of countries, and more are considering the same scheme, like Denmark.
Basically, when I look at Rwanda, it's a country that has suffered genocide, what has been going on in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. And while it suffered genocide, it's also true that so many bad things have been going on in terms of governance, in terms of human rights committed in the country. And so for Kagame, who runs Rwanda, other than money, the other thing is that when countries, especially very powerful countries and rich countries like United Kingdom, make such a deal with him, then they cannot turn around and say, oh, Kagame, you are committing human rights abuses. You have to keep quiet because you've made a deal with him. He's given you something and you are giving him something. So you're kind of locked up in some kind of mutual blackmail.
So you're speaking from experience because you were a close part of President Kagame's inner circle for years. I mean, Rwanda is considered by many to be a dictatorship. What else are we missing from the story?
I think Rwanda is a victim of its own tragic history, because what happened in Rwanda in 1994, the genocide, left many people in the international community guilty. You know, the big powers, the United Nations, almost every other, even African countries, by the way, I think we should point out, because nobody came to the defense of the Rwandan people in the hour of need. And because of that silence and to stop the genocide, the international community has been operating on this guilt that nothing was done. So, and when I used to be part of the inner circle, part of the Kagame's inner circle, when I was ambassador here, we used it effectively. Every time people would be critical of the policies of the government, would say, aha, what were you doing in 1994? And then they would have to keep quiet. But in the meantime, Rwanda really has a very, very abhorrent human rights record. If you look at the current United States State Department Human Rights Report or Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International or a report that was done by the United Nations that clearly showed war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so when all these things are done and the world keeps silent, one of the consequences is that Kagame is very efficient in trying to attract this kind of silence against these human rights abuses by making deals of this nature. And the world is largely missing this very sad story, and it keeps on happening.
Well, the authoritarianism of President Kagame, where critics are often arrested or even killed, and that guilt you talked about of the international community after the 1994 genocide, it does all make Rwanda a curious choice for the UK to send asylum seekers to. Why do you think the UK is all in on this? I mean, they're paying Rwanda, as we said, an initial sum of over $150 million. What does the UK get out of it?
I think it gets out of it, I'm sorry to say, if you're an African, if you're black, or you're a Muslim, or you're an Arab. And remember, most of these people that will be sent to Rwanda under this plan are people from Syria, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, or from North Africa. Many people, including myself, would say they are racist undertones, a policy of this nature. Of course, Mr. Johnson and Ms. Preet Patel, the Home Secretary, their interest is to look at their domestic constituencies, how to deal with a domestic public issue. They say, oh, we don't need to have these immigrants. They have come here through, they are smugglers. But if these were not Muslims or Syrians or Iraqis or Afghanistan or people from North Africa, I do not think a country would deport them to a distant country, especially for a country that has such an abhorrent human rights record.
Théogène Rudasingwa was Rwanda's ambassador to the U.S. from 1996 to 99, and also President Paul Kagame's chief of staff from 2000 to 2004. He now lives near Washington, D.C. Dr. Rudasingwa, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
22 years ago, a towering figure in Haiti was gunned down outside the radio station he ran. Even today, Jean Dominique is still a household name for Haitians. No one knows exactly who was behind his assassination, but Dominique had plenty of enemies. His station, Radio Haiti Inter, was unique. It was on the air for decades and shut down soon after Dominique's death. Its political programs were broadcast not only in French, the language of the powerful elites, but also in Haitian Creole, Haiti's universal language spoken by rich and poor alike. Now that trove of audio material from Radio Haiti is getting a second life. From the podcast about language, Subtitle, reporter Patrick Cox has a story.
Information. Toutes les nouvelles du monde entier. The story of Haiti's most influential radio station, its rise and fall and rebirth online. It's a story with a huge cast of characters. But at the center are three people. There's Jean-Dominique, of course, who bought Radio Haiti in the 1960s when the country was under a dictatorship. Dominique ran the station until he was killed in April 2000.
He was this brilliant, fearless journalist and activist.
This is Laura Wagner, the founding director of the Radio Haiti Archive.
He was sort of a combination of Edward R. Murrow, in that he was the most recognized voice in Haitian media. He was part Ida B. Wells, doing investigations while also speaking truth to power, and part Studs Terkel, sort of a storyteller focused on the lives of ordinary people.
And when Dominique spoke, people listened.
There is something going on in a small piece of land called Haiti. 6 million people, poor, illiterate, black, dirty, at the bottom of the human life. But this country has something to tell you.
And as a journalist, even though he spoke a lot, he also put a lot of emphasis on listening, especially to marginalized people. He used to use this expression, which was, I need to sit on my school bench and learn from the people.
The second person in this story is Jean-Dominique's widow, Michelle Montas. For decades, she ran Radio Haiti's newsroom.
Like Jean, she is really passionate and driven by her convictions. And after he was assassinated, she took on even more of a public-facing role at the station. And like him, she came from a relatively privileged background.
Montas spoke with me from New York, where she lives now.
At school, we spoke French to the teachers. When we were out playing in the yard, we would speak Creole to each other. Of course, we were punished for it, but we did anyway. And I'm sure any Haitian who is drowning, whether he's French-speaking or not, will just yell in Creole, "En way!"
Before Radio Haiti, you mainly heard Creole on the airwaves in commercials. Montas and Dominique gradually brought it into their news coverage, but they started with cultural programs.
Radio Haiti présente Gouverneur de la Rosée.
Like this radio play based on a French language novel set in Haiti. Dominique kept the narration in French, but translated the dialogue into Creole. The play is about farm workers rising up and organizing against oppressive landowners. It was fiction, not news. So Michel Montas says it didn't bother Haiti's authorities.
Talking about actual events, happening, things that were happening, that would have worried them. But I think it was a part of Jean's effort to bring Haitian culture. It means everything. It meant everything from literature to music.
Hearing the Creole language gave ordinary Haitians a sense of belonging to the radio station and to society at large.
Creole came into existence because of the Atlantic slave trade.
This is archivist Laura Wagner again.
In the 17th and 18th centuries, there were hundreds of thousands of African people who were enslaved in Saint-Domingue, the French colony that later became Haiti. These enslaved people came from different ethnic and linguistic groups in Africa, so they weren't able to communicate without a common language. And they developed Creole in order to communicate, which allowed them eventually to organize among themselves against their enslavers.
Wagner herself learned to speak Creole. She's really the third character in this story. She was a fluent speaker by the time she met Michel Montas at Duke University. That was more than a decade after Jean-Dominique's assassination.
It was extremely important to me when I donated Radio Haiti's archive to Duke University that the audio archives be made available to Haitians in Haiti. The initiative taken by Laura Wagner, who was and remains the soul of these archives, to introduce each recording in English, French, and Creole, was really more than I expected. But it was exactly what I wanted.
That decision to provide descriptions in Creole of 5,000 separate audio files made all the difference for the many Haitians who couldn't read French or English.
The Creole description meant access. It also meant respect. Respect for language that had no respect before.
No one, though, is kidding themselves that things are improving in Haiti, either for the people or the language. Michel Montaz says in some ways things have gone backwards. The voices of poor Creole speakers are still excluded from the national conversation, she says. But at least Radio Haiti's archive is there now, preserved and accessible as a beacon of possibility. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Rare scenes in Syria yesterday. Large crowds of people flocked to prisons following news of a prisoner release. It is reported that about 60 prisoners were let go. Videos and images of the freed Syrians quickly emerged on social media, including fresh accounts of brutal conditions behind bars. With us now to discuss this is Natasha Hall. She's a senior fellow with the Center for International Strategic Studies in Washington. Natasha, why the release of these 60-some-odd prisoners, and why now?
That's a good question. It's not entirely clear why now, but the timing of this amnesty is interesting because a few events have collided all at once. For one, the regime has been known to issue amnesties during holidays like Eid, which was this Monday. The Brussels conference has also begun this week, and this is an event held every year where donor governments are talking about how much to give to Syria and aid and how to give such assistance to Syria. But I suppose, the real catalyst was likely this in-depth report and clear video footage released last week, this investigation and video of a 2013 massacre in the southern suburbs of Damascus. And the massacre was clearly carried out by people wearing official military uniforms. And so I think, you know, even though everyone knows by now the brutality of this regime, this report reminded people at a time when there has been a gradual shift to normalization with the regime.
What is the possibility this prisoner release might signal more amnesties to come?
I think that there's reasons to be cautious about that. As I mentioned, this is the most far-reaching one, so I honestly doubt it's going to lead to others in the future. But I think we also need to pay attention to a few more things: the actual numbers of people released and the conditions under which these people are released. And if some prisoners today, those that are still in prison, have additional charges added to their file, so that they wouldn't be eligible for release with this amnesty. This has been a tactic used by the regime multiple times before.
Well, 60 prisoners released yesterday is just a fraction of the thousands of people still languishing in Syrian government prisons. That's according to Human Rights Watch. How and why did so many Syrians end up in detention?
Well, lacking legitimacy, this regime governs through fear and violence. And when tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in Syria took to the streets in 2011 demanding change, repressing them through fear and mass violence was the regime's answer. And, you know, the initial murder, arrests, and torture of protesters and imputed activists led to this full-blown revolution. And the regime never let up on detention and torture throughout. So, I mean, by now, by some estimates, 100,000 people have died in detention and hundreds of thousands more have been through Syria's detention centers.
What do we know precisely about what happens inside?
Though there's no access to these prisons and detention centers, we know a lot because of how many people have been through them. And we know even more because of evidence smuggled out of Syria. And because of that unprecedented amount of evidence, we know that they are regularly and severely tortured, both physically and psychologically. We know that they're overcrowded. We know that prisoners are forced to fight over a limited amount of food, and many die under these conditions or through torture or are summarily executed and thrown into what are now numerous mass graves that now dot, you know, the Syrian landscape. I have one friend that believes that he was the only one to survive amongst nearly 200 people he was in prison with. And with this release, we know of at least one man who doesn't even know who he is anymore, literally. And I think, you know, that is what prison is meant to do. It's meant to break you.
Natasha Hall is a senior fellow with the Center for International Strategic Studies. She joined us from Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In Italy, when babies are born, for the most part, they are given their father's last name by law. But that could be about to change. Italy's top court ruled last week that the law is unconstitutional. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The case that prompted this decision was brought by a couple in southern Italy. They're unnamed in court documents. The couple had two children before they were married. The father didn't legally recognize the children at first, so they got their mother's last name. Some years later, the couple got married and had a third child. They wanted to give the baby the same name as her siblings. The family's lawyer, Gianpaolo Brienza, says it was a matter of family cohesion.
It was in the best interest of the child. It would have been absurd, especially in such a small community, for two siblings to have one name and the third a different one.
Brienza says the couple thought about changing the names of the older children, but that didn't make any sense.
The older sister is 14 years old. For 14 years, she's gone by one name. It would have been inappropriate, traumatic even, to make her change it.
So the mother's last name it was, except it wasn't, because in Italy, children always get their father's last name unless the mother is single or the father refuses to be a part of the children's lives. The family's case went to Italy's top court, and it ruled that from now on, when children are born, they'll automatically get two last names on their birth certificate, one from the mother and one from the father. The parents decide the order. If the parents want to give their child just one last name, they can do that too, and it can be either the mother's or the father's. Naming conventions are a funny thing. They're different from country to country, even countries in the same region. In the U.S., we're used to children getting their father's last name. It's called patrilineal surnaming, same thing in England. But in Spain, children get two last names, one from the mother, one from the father. Iceland doesn't have last names the way we think of them. They have names like Helgason, which means son of Helga, or Leif's daughter, daughter of Leif. And in China, though it's by no means the norm, some families give one child the father's last name and one child the mother's. All this to say, when it comes to names, there are lots of models. Christine Mallinson is a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She studies patrilineal surname conventions.
There's no right or wrong for how people decide what names to give their families or their children or whatever the case may be. But I am interested in more people having those conversations, as opposed to what often happens, which is male naming be taken as just the assumed or the default practice.
Mallinson says patrilineal surnames grew out of a patriarchal culture. No surprise there. This ruling, she says, indicates Italy is ready for a change.
It's a nod to gender equality, to a different way of doing things, and it feels contemporary.
Parliament still has to pass a law to put the changes into place and work out the exact naming conventions. Italy's family minister pledged the government's full support. She wrote on Facebook, quote, "This is a fundamental step to achieve equality between men and women." Though more than one user wrote in the comments, "How about fully paid maternity leave?" For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. You can find us online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.